Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today, I want to talk about a number of topics. One would be the shutdown in the U.S. of the government and its impact, growing impact on the economy. Brexit, what the status of that is in the U.K., U.S.-China trade, which is going to come to a head here in the next round of negotiations next week. I want to say something as well about what's going on in Venezuela and the Trump administration role in that, but then spend most of the time talking about the gathering of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, and the red flags from big investors and capitalists that have been increasingly raised in recent weeks here about the global economy on the eve of the Davos meeting. By the way, if folks are interested in more detail on my analysis of Davos here on my blog, jackrasmus.com, you can read my latest entry on the global economy on the brink as the Davos crowd parties on. That's jackrasmus.com. Also, a number of public blogs, Counterpunch, ZNet, Global Research have all run that piece. Okay, let's start out with Venezuela. If some of you have been following that, as you know, in recent days here, the Trump administration has taken the position of recognizing the head or the chair, I forget what his title is here, his name is Guaido, of the one of the two national assemblies, legislation bodies in Venezuela. There are actually two of them. One is the old one, controlled by the right wing, pro-US, pro-business right wing. And then there were elections, and a new National Assembly was created. So we have what we call the condition of dual power, historical term, in Venezuela. And whenever you see dual power, you you know it's a revolutionary or counter-revolutionary situation. For years, the U.S. has tried to overturn the Venezuela government by subsidizing and promoting conservative forces in the legislature. And that's not proved very effective for the U.S. and imperial interests. They haven't been able to dislodge the current president, Maduro, and his predecessor, Chavez, as a result of that particular strategy, street protests, financing the right-wing groups, trying to put pressure on big business people in, and generals, the military in Venezuela. That hasn't proved very, very effective to date. It's been countered in check several times in by Venezuela. So now we've got a recognition by Trump. They've upped the ante here, Trump has, and is recognizing as president the head of the conservative-dominated legislature, the one that was previous to the recent national elections that elected a new legislature. Okay, so by saying that the head of the legislature is now the head of state, the president, Trump has created the next level of dual power conflict there in Venezuela. And what's going on now is they're lining up other states, other governments in Latin America to oppose Venezuela. As you may know, this very right-wing fascist kind of fellow ex-military captain Bolsonaro has recently taken over the presidency in Brazil after a legal coup of sorts. And this guy in Argentina, Macri, same thing, comes to power on a U.S. Assisted engineered legal coup citing corruption of the other elected and impeaching the elected other elected presidents there in Brazil and Argentina. And maneuvers going on have been going on in other places, Panama, Peru, Chile, by the U.S., lining up these countries who are part of what's called the Organization of American States, OAS, and lining up OAS whenever the U.S. wants to make a move in South America, it lines up the OAS behind it. And what was ominous is that this morning, this guy Bolsonaro, a real fascist, makes Trump look like a liberal. Bolsonaro announced that Brazil's ready to send in troops. All right, this is the first salvo here of lining up military, possible military intervention in Venezuela by the United States, because the previous strategy of trying to take over through the legislature is not working, hasn't worked for years, several aborted attempts, and it doesn't look like it can work since this new assembly was elected there, which is very pro Maduro and the Chavez revolution there that's been going on since the early 2000s. So this more direct, blatant offensive is now being launched, raising the specter, a very real specter of military intervention in Venezuela. Russia and I believe China may have as well come out warnings to the U.S. about direct interference. Other states in Latin America that haven't been turned to the right are opposed to it. Uruguay, I think, and I think Bolivia. And, of course, Mexico is saying, let's have some dialogue. Let's, you know, Mexico's not for this. There were a couple aborted military coups here in this month by lower level second tier military in Venezuela, captain's coups, you might say, mutinies that were put down. And the Venezuela high level brass has pretty much come out in favor of Maduro on TV and regionally. All the regional generals have come out in favor of Maduro. The U.S. will, of course, continue to try to turn some or one or more of those. But what you got now very clearly is the military, at least the brass, aligned behind the Maduro government and the U.S., getting Bolsonaro and soon others, I'm sure, to threaten military intervention. Well, this has the fingerprints of Bolton, John Bolton, and Pompeo, you know, who are right-wing militarist neocons now in key positions in the Trump administration, right? There are certain risks to this, of course. It could get very messy, as some of the liberal media in the U.S. is raising. Trump has put himself in a position that if this strategy does not prevail, it makes him look weaker and the U.S. look weaker which kind of pushes him towards military intervention. The U.S., of course, will not send U.S. troops. It will finance the cost of the intervention by the other states, by Brazil and others down there. This Bolsonaro is a big admirer of Trump. They're cut from the same cloth. Provide other kind of logistics support, intelligence and spying, you know, drones and military and support, aircraft support and so forth. So that's what the U.S. will do. And there's risk that this thing could get out of hand. If it doesn't pull off, it makes Trump look weak and the U.S. look weak. And if they go military action, well, that's unpredictable. What could happen? You could have sympathetic uprisings in Brazil and Argentina and other places on behalf of Venezuela. And that's a big negative if that happens. That would threaten the U.S. recent gaining of control once again in the two biggest economies there in South America, Argentina and Brazil, should that happen. And you could have a conflagration erupting all across South America. So that's a big risk by the Trump Bolton, you know, reckless Bolton Pompeo, reckless right wing neocons in the U.S. here that now have Trump's attention on this. Of course, there are some short term favorable consequences for Trump. There's a big distraction, you see, if this thing escalates. It's a big distraction for what's going on with the U.S. government shutdown and with, you know, likely Mueller report coming out and everything. You know, when attacked and put in a corner, politicians typically look to external affairs and foreign policy and create a crisis in order to distract and rally people around them. No doubt if things get hotter in Venezuela, Trump and the Democrats will close ranks on that particular issue. Right? There's another thing that may be behind this, and that is a way of bolstering global oil prices, you see. As I've talked about before and written about on my blog, jackerasmus.com, last summer, Trump shot himself in the foot on global oil. The U.S. policy has been to help Saudi Arabia and U.S. oil companies prop up global oil prices by creating shortages. And the idea was to block Iranian oil last spring and summer, which would cause more of a shortage, with sanctions, by the way, U.S. sanctions on, on Iranian oil, which would cause a short-term supply issue and which would drive up the price of oil, which, you know, the Saudi Arabia government and Trump, very closely in bed together, would love to see. Because Saudi Arabia is having economic problems now, raising money because the price of oil has fallen. And they're trying to even sell shares into their Arabian oil company here to raise money. So back to Iran, Trump shot himself in the foot by announcing these sanctions and giving the announcement and the anticipation of a shortage, global oil shortage, the Saudis started pumping more oil. They thought they were going to grab the sales contraction from the sanctions of Iranian oil. So they pumped it, you know, they pumped more supply into the global economy. And the Russians did the same to try to take advantage. You know, if the Saudis are raising the price, the Russians will raise theirs because they need to raise money from oil sales to finance, you know, their government spending. And U.S. shale oil producers just kept pumping more and more oil throughout last year as well, because a lot of the drillers have borrowed a lot of short-term junk bond money and have to generate revenue to pay that junk bond high principal and interest. that they got. So that's why the U.S. Shale oils just keep producing, right? And causing an excess supply in the world. And the Saudis did the same, as I said, you know, following Iran, and the Russians followed. So last year you got this massive increase of excess oil, which drove down the price of oil, you know. Economics 101, you raise this supply and it'll drive down the price. Well, that's what happened. And then, of course, Trump exacerbated the Iranian thing after he calls for sanctions. He allowed all of the all kinds of exemptions to the sanctions. And that caught the Saudis off guard, you see. They thought they were going to get the lion's share of the decrease in Iranian oil exports, and they pumped all that extra oil, and then the Iranian exports didn't go down that much, and now you got had an excess of oil. So back to Venezuela, you know, create a crisis in Venezuela and thereby do the same kind of a thing, you know, impose sanctions on Venezuela, tough sanctions, which Trump is now doing as well, create a shortage, in other words, try to prevent Venezuelan oil from coming, particularly to the United States. You see, a lot of the southern Gulf states, Texas and so forth, refiners rely on Venezuelan oil. So if you cut off that crude oil from Venezuela, right, now you've got a shortage for refiners in parts of the United States. Well, Trump is doing that, see? So he's trying to create more of a shortage of oil. This is, you know, a secondary objective here in Venezuela. Create a shortage to drive up the price of oil to help the Saudis, you know, who are trying to do the same with a program to reduce the supply of oil now. You see, oil gets mixed up in all these global political machinations, you know, always. The oil companies, big oil companies, a lot of money to be made, and a lot of campaign contributions to politicians follow. And with the price of oil, you know, having fallen there once again, 40% once that whole Iranian thing began last summer. In the second half of the year, the price of oil collapsed 40%, 40, right? Which dropped, revenues for oil companies, especially the Saudis, who are buddy-buddy with Trump. There's been desperate attempts to get the price of oil back up ever since. The Saudis went and cut a deal with the Russians to try and OPEC to try to raise prices through cutting supplies. Well, you could argue that Trump is adding to that and trying to rectify the screw-up he did here with Iranian sanctions by sanctioning Venezuela and causing a crisis in Venezuela so that the oil exports, dry up out of Venezuela. That puts a real pressure on Venezuela's economy because Venezuela's government spending, 95% comes from oil sales. So they're totally dependent on oil, you see. And the U.S. has been squeezing Venezuela for some time that way. The main, as I've talked about before, the main way in which the U.S. up to now has been putting the economic screws to Venezuela is to dry up its access to U.S. dollars currency. It's instituted the last several years various measures to prevent U.S. companies from keeping their money in Venezuela, moving that money out, even doing things to encourage the money, dollars, to move out of Venezuela to Colombia. In other words, just squeezing the access to dollars as Venezuela's oil production slowed and therefore decreased access to dollars as well. And when you don't have dollars, your currency collapses. And that's what's happened in Venezuela for some years now. And you can't buy needed, necessary imports from other countries because you don't have the dollars, especially medicines and certain food products and so forth. And that causes domestic unrest And that becomes the basis for trying to overthrow the government. So U.S. dollar policy has been the primary economic lever against Venezuela up to now. But that hasn't produced the results that Trump wanted. And so now they're rolling the dice. Trump and Bolton and company are rolling the dice to see whether they could use this guy Bolsonaro maybe to have a more aggressive strategy. You couldn't do this without Bolsonaro, you see, playing this role. Well, we'll see what happens here. Next week, we will have some guests on the show, and we'll focus at least a half an hour on what's going on in Venezuela economically and politically. I'm sure this thing is really going to heat up here as time goes by. Okay, moving on. Now, let's talk about the government shutdown. You know, when the shutdown started, the official Trump position was that it's having minimal effects on the economy, right? Well, they can't hide it anymore. It's becoming obvious more and more that their initial minimal estimation was really based upon the fact that 800,000 government workers would not have money for consumption, right? And that contractors, government contractors, would not get money, and then some government spending programs would be, put up, destabilized, suspended for a period of time. Well, it's become clear that those direct effects now have indirect effects as well, and that is, it's not just wages and contractors, but it affects the housing sector and issuing of mortgages and therefore housing sales, which are already weak. It affects business investment, confidence. If it looks like this thing just keeps going on, business simply suspends its investment plans, holds up, delays its investment plans, and the thing begins to have a snowball effect on other sectors of the real economy. Now, the shutdown thing effect is coming on top of some other problems in the U.S. economy here that are coinciding in the first quarter. And one is, of course, the China trade effects. I've been saying it hasn't had that much direct effect on exports, the China-U.S. trade war. But it is having an effect on business confidence and investment. Should there not be a trade deal here after February, then we'll see those tariffs implement on both sides, China and the U.S., then we will see a much, much greater impact from the China trade war. We'll see a real trade war begin there, should that happen. But it's already having an effect on business confidence, therefore investment, and therefore economic growth in the U.S. And this comes on top of Fed rate hikes that have been going on up to now that are now beginning to have an impact in the economy, on autos, on housing, and other areas, right? And on top of the stock market, U.S. beginning to waver and gather momentum for a continued downward decline in stock prices in the U.S. Now, that affects wealthy folks, the top 10% households, and their what's called their wealth effect, which affects consumption, you see. Doesn't affect the bottom 90% that much because they don't have stocks. But when, you know, those who have a lot of stocks see the price of their stock decline, then they hold up some of their purchases. It has an effect on consumption, which is almost 70% of the economy. Right? And business and consumer confidence also begins to have an effect, negative effect here. Right. So the shutdown and its direct and indirect effects, on housing and so forth, are overlaid now in the first quarter with China trade effects beginning to occur, Fed rate hikes now beginning to hit the economy, stock market wealth effects, right, and general business consumer confidence beginning to wane in the U.S. So it's going to be hard to estimate how much the shutdown is affecting negatively first quarter GDP in the U.S. and how much all these other things are. And it is coming when you have this quarter, first quarter, that is always much weaker than the rest of the year in terms of economic growth in the U.S. I believe and have said that has to do with very poor seasonality adjustments to GDP and prices and wages and so forth in the U.S. Statistics. Actually, if you look at U.S. GDP and you eliminate the redefinitions of GDP that occurred in 2013, the U.S. had a very mild double-dip recession in 2011-12 and maybe in late 2016 as well. Certainly a stagnation of growth. So, you know, all these things are beginning to converge here in the first quarter that's always weak for reasons we just indicated, right? But Trump doesn't care as far as this shutdown is concerned. You know, Trump is not the president of the United States. Trump is the president of 35% of the United States. Everything he does, policy-wise, from immigration to shutdown to everything, is really targeting that base. How can he keep that base on his side and agitated? You know, that's all he represents. Because he knows his existence, not just a potential re-election in 2020, but his very existence until then as president, depends upon that base supporting him and his ability to agitate that base when the Dems and the liberals come after him, as they will here with the Mueller report, which will come out before the middle of the year. So he's a president of one-third of the country, and he's clearly beginning to move to a tougher position here. I believe and have predicted that, you know, he will, if the Democrats don't cave in, and that's a big if, they typically do, but if they don't cave in for, and this goes on for another month, the shutdown, then he will declare a national emergency and end it that way and implement his wall and pay for his wall by taking money from the defense. And then they'll just restore what they took from the defense because the new budget's coming up here in March. He cannot allow the shutdown effects on the economy growing. At the same time, he may have a failure of the negotiations with China, and we may have a trade war erupting in March. He can't have a shutdown in March and a trade war in March. That would have a real negative effect on the stock market. You would see a big correction, 20-30% more in the stock market if that happens. So I predict that if the Democrats hold firm, he will declare a national emergency to end this thing and get his wall. But I also predict, and we'll talk about this now, that the China trade war, China-U.S. trade war, will be resolved. I'm not going to go into all the details on that, on the various factions and so forth. I've talked about that at length in previous shows. But I will make a note of a curious event this past week, and that was the public rumor that was raised that, the Chinese aren't coming over for high-level negotiations on January 30th as previously announced. Chinese, in this case, being the second in command, Xi, China President Xi, which his name is Liu He, I believe that's how you pronounce it, Liu He, main negotiator for China on trade and other things. He was scheduled to come over on the 30th to have these high-level negotiations. And China, as I said last week, is making all kind of public concessions before the meeting, agreeing to 51% ownership to satisfy U.S. bankers and multinational corporations, 51% ownership in China, agreeing to buy $1 trillion more of U.S. farm and other goods, and to eliminate the trade deficit by, I think it's 2023 with the U.S. You know, just 5 years, eliminate. Well, they're going to buy a lot of stuff. You know, a lot of soybean agribusiness farmers are going to love that, and manufacturers in the Midwest. So two big concessions, but the big crux of the trade problem, as I've said repeatedly, is the technology issue. And it's not clear how much China will back up on the technology issue, although they are making some overtures there. The national legislature in China is supposed to pass some laws about intellectual property and tech transfer limits, etc., by January 29th, in other words, before Liu He comes over. By the way, if you want to read my latest up to last week analysis of the China-U.S. trade, again on my blog is the piece, Trump's Deja Vu China Trade War, Part 2. I previously posted Part 1, but Part 2 brings it right up to the present here. But the interesting thing that happened last week was that this rumor popped up that there might be a cancellation of Liu He's coming to the United States. Well, to me, this is an attempt. This was an attempt by the neocon, pro-military Pentagon, anti-China hawk faction on the U.S. trade team led by Robert Lighthizer, the chief trade negotiator with his two right-wing buddies there, Bolton and Peter Navarro, also anti-China hawks. I think they threw this this rumor up to see what would happen. But quickly, Trump's economic advisor, Kudlow, jumped in and said, no, it's on, they're coming. And some lower-level folks will be coming a couple of days before. The Liu He thing is still on for January 30th, 31st. That will be the critical negotiations. And we may see some more attempts to scuttle it by the Lighthizer faction that doesn't want to see China advancing its new technologies, 5G, wireless, cybersecurity, and artificial intelligence, does not want to see this happen because these are military technologies as well. And the U.S., Lighthizer and so forth, would like to blow up the trade deal, I believe, in order to launch a new Cold War with China, with the U.S., which would result in a massive increase in government funding for these new technologies. Okay. We'll talk about that, too, next week, because this will be right after the Liu He coming in on the 30th, which I think is the middle of next week. And we'll talk about that in Venezuela next week. Two big events next week. Okay. So I think ultimately, though, China and the U.S. will come to an agreement on trade. I think the hardliners will lose out in this particular case because there's so much money to be made by the other capitalists in the U.S. You know, the bankers and multinationals will make big bucks by getting majority ownership in China. China will agree to some token wording on technology transfer in China. Doesn't mean it's enforceable, especially over the long run, to try to placate the hardliners. But the bankers will get a big win. And, of course, agribusiness and manufacturers in the U.S. that export to China will also get a big win. I mean, $1 trillion in extra buying of U.S. goods by China over the next 5 years and eliminating the $375 billion annual trade deficit. Wow, that's a big deal. That's a big concession by China, those two items. And I think that will prevail ultimately over the hardliners' attempts to prevent a trade deal here. They want China to capitulate on this technology thing even before they get here. You know, the Lighthizer faction said all of these concessions by China are not good enough. You got to agree to it before you get here. Well, what the hell is that? That's not negotiations. You know, that's like in labor management negotiations, management saying to the union, you got to agree to our 20% cut in your health care before we'll sit down and talk with you. That's what that is, right? Well, no serious, you know, union or country is going to pre-agree before it sits down. But that's a way of trying to scuttle the gathering, the meeting itself, you know. If they don't agree to your pre-demands, well, okay, let's call it off, right? That's what the Lighthizer Group wants to do. Okay. Let's move on also to an event of this past week, which is Brexit, and another one of my predictions. And Brexit, of course, is this United Kingdom, Britain move out of the customs union, the European customs union there, and going local. Going on its own, right? Prime Minister May, of course, could not push this terrible deal she negotiated with the European Union, you know, the Eurozone, European Union, on the terms and conditions of getting out of the deal. Most people aren't aware of the terms and conditions, but you know, just some of the more onerous. The Europeans are saying that Britain must pay them $60 billion to leave. Yeah. And it can't agree to any independent trade deals after it leaves with the U.S. or other countries. In other words, it's still really in for 18 months. Even after it leaves, it's in for 18 months, right? And, you know, the Europeans have used the Ireland and Scotland angles to lever this really onerous deal with the UK, May's deal, right? And Ireland, of course, is playing the EU, supporting all its positions. And that's because, you know, Northern Ireland, there's a border there with Ireland, Northern Ireland. And if you're in the EU, there's no tariffs, there's no checkpoints and nothing like that. But if Britain leaves the EU, Northern Ireland's part of Britain. And therefore, and now you got checkpoints and so forth and fees and et cetera. Well, Ireland is playing sort of lead disruptor on behalf of the European Union. Why? Because Ireland has been allowed in the European Union to have this special status of very low taxes, you see, to attract investment, very low taxes. And Ireland doesn't want to give that up. And then you got Scotland that's been on the side of the EU as well. Why? Because right now Scotland gets a lot of money and taxes from the sale of North Sea oil off its shore to the EU. It doesn't want to leave either. So the best May could get was this horrendous deal that the British Parliament won't accept. It's so bad. They're between a rock and a hard place, you know. One is if they leave on March 29th in what's called a hard Brexit, well, then who knows what's going to happen to the British economy. At least that's the spin that's going on now. You know, visions of trucks lined up for, you know, tens of miles here trying to get in and out of Britain. And worse, assumptions, crises. I think it's overblown myself. I don't think that economic impact would be all that bad. But the media and press is really pumping it up. You know, we've seen that in the U.S. too, in 2013, when the fiscal cliff, as it was called, if you don't extend the tax cuts that Bush and you gave to businesses here, then the economy is going to collapse, right? Yeah, that was a hype thing too. He agreed. Obama agreed to extend the Bush tax cuts for 10 more years at a cost of $5 trillion. Yeah, that was the so-called fiscal cliff. So you make it look like if you don't do this, oh, crisis, the sky's going to fall, right? Well, I think there's some of that going on in Brexit as well, because, basically the national capitalists in Britain do not want a Brexit here. And their whole strategy has been to delay the implementation of it as much as they can, right? This is a faction within the Conservative Party. And what they really want is to have another referendum. You see, this Brexit thing was a referendum of the people. And you can't get much more democratic than that. The people voted on it in June 2016 and said, let's leave. For reasons I'm not going to talk about, but I have an article from back then. You may want to look at it. Brexit as a working class rebellion against free trade. But anyway, they're in a rock and a hard place. They can't leave, they think, in a hard break, because that will cause all kinds of economic dislocation. But this deal is so onerous, they can't accept that either. Parliament's going back and forth. I think when the deadline comes on March 29th, my prediction is they'll kick that can down the road again. The EU has put these onerous conditions on the UK because it really wants to make it look like anyone try to leave the European Union, boy, you're going to pay a price. You know, you're politically, economically, we're going to screw you good. Well, that's how they terrorized the Greeks into staying in a few years back, despite all the debt and the exploitation, austerity, and so forth. And that's the same game they're playing with the Italian populace now, who are trying to exert more independence. Once you get locked into these pan-country capitalist structures, you know, like the European Union, the Eurozone, and so forth, boy, it's hard to get out. It's hard to get out. And a lot of European countries realize this now. And I think the EU is putting the screws to the UK, making it pay a terrible price if it wants to leave, as a signal to all the other Eurozone countries that would, you know, consider the same. Well, my prediction is they'll kick the can down the road, and ultimately, and voices are increasingly being raised in the UK, there has to be a second referendum. Well, you know, what's that going to do to democracy in Britain, right? It doesn't matter if you vote. If the elites don't like it, you know, they'll wait you out and they'll put the squeeze on you and you vote again until you do like it. Well, we've seen that in American union negotiations all the time. That goes on all the time. You know, if you don't get a vote the business does not like, well, they put it to another vote. Well, you know, a few years ago, that's what happened to Boeing Machinist Workers Union, right? they had a vote, and the workers voted down the contract deal, and then the union leaders just waited till the Christmas holiday when people weren't around to vote, and they put another vote, and they pushed it through, see? Well, you know, that's a micro example of what's going on in the UK here, I think. All right, so Brexit prediction follows my China trade prediction that there'll be a deal. Brexit prediction, they'll kick the can down the road and at some point, try to get a second referendum. You can already see the business press warming up to the idea of a second referendum there. Okay, let's turn to Davos, right? Global economy fading, right? This hyped up 2017 synchronized global recovery and growth is now a clearly synchronized global slowdown. They're all admitting it, right? Germany, one-third of the Eurozone GDP, Third quarter, negative growth, minus 0.2, negative GDP growth, right? Fourth quarter, probably going to be negative again. If so, then it's in a technical recession. The Deutsche Bank forecast is Germany will only grow 1% this coming year. I think that's high. a number of forces are converging on Germany and Europe, really slowing its economy down there. I think the whole European economy only grew by 0.2% in the third quarter, or Eurozone at least. China is slowing down, and that's slowing down trade with Europe. And Germany, being the heart of a European economy, depends heavily on exports and trade. 47% of the German economy is exports. You know, that's a big number. And if exports slow down because of the slowing economy and because of China, a lot of business there, then you're going to have a problem in Germany. And its manufacturing index clearly is down, negative. Its industrial production, which is utilities, manufacturing, and a few other, mining, October, November, contracted by 1.9%. Okay, so the indicators are pretty strong. World autos are collapsing. Auto sales in Germany depends on that. Germany is very soft, stagnant at best, and contracting here. And if we have a worsening of a trade war, we'll contract even more. France's purchasing manager indexes dropped below 50 at 48 point something. Well, that means it's contracting. Manufacturing and services are contracting in France. Italy, same thing, probably in a recession right now as well. The IMF is revising its forecast for the global economy downward. Even so, chronically optimistic, always has been. In terms of forecasts of a global economy and what's wrong with them, why they're, you know, the World Bank and IMF, BIS, and so forth, why they always overestimate. The first chapter of my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility and Global Economy, really addresses this question of overly optimistic forecasts. But even though they're optimistic globally, IMF is reducing them, right? Because it knows what's coming here. The advanced economies will grow only by 2%, according to the IMF most recent World Economic Outlook forecast here. World Bank reducing it as well. The UN United Nations trade body, I forget the name of it, it reported in 2018, foreign direct investment is down 19%. So the money is not flowing out from the big advanced economies, particularly the United States, to the rest of the world at the magnitude it was, and not financing investment, which is slowing down the global economy. Okay. My predictions for the U.S. economy first quarter is that it'll come in around 1%. And if this GDP the shutdown drags on through February, it could even be flat. My prediction for the U.S. economy is also that we will slip into stagnation or recession in the fourth quarter of this year. So the total growth will probably not be more than 1.5%, 1%, 1.5%, which is about half of what it was last year. So the U.S. economy is slowing rapidly, right? Okay, so that's my focus, my prediction here for these various economies. Of course, Japan flirting once again with recession, stagnation, which it has been for quite some time. And then the China economy slowing down officially to 6.6%. But if you look at the trends in the second half of 2018, That's where that decline to 6.6% comes from. And if these trends continue in China throughout 2019, we're going to have much less than 6% coming year. And in any event, I think that 6.6% is because of the way they gather data in China. That it's already less than 6%. So we could fall to 5% if the trends in the second half of next year. If you look at housing is down. Retail sales, especially autos in China, are down. Its purchasing manager manufacturing index slid below 50, which is contraction here. Fixed investment, which has been a very important part of China growth, which was 20% in 2010 of the economy, GDP, and even as recent as 2016 was around 15%. Now fixed investment is only 5%. China has been trying to stimulate its economy with a package of monetary fiscal policy, but it's clear it's been doing this for like 5-6 years. Whenever there's a slowdown, it throws more money into the economy, does a little more government spending. But the bang for the buck is declining. In other words, they have to put in more and more money for less and less actual GDP. I believe the ratio there is they have to spend and stimulate 4% or $4 or 4 yuan for every one boost to GDP. It used to be almost 1-to-1 in China. Now it's 4-to-1. Well, that's a sign that the stimulus packages are getting weaker and weaker. Right. Tail risks also to the global economy are very clear. We've got Brexit. We've got Italian banks and their non-performing loans. We have the protest in France. We'll hit consumption, who knows what else. We have China-U.S. trade. We have the shutdown. We have the Mueller report when it comes out. It looks like gridlock from next 2 years in the U.S. We have a China slowdown. We have Japan recessions. We have emerging market instabilities and so forth. And then these forecasts by IMF, World Bank, and so forth, not just them, but by a whole host of private banks, Nomura Bank, for example, Citigroup Index, Goldman Sachs report, etc., Consensus Economics, Reuters, they're all showing a weakening. Now, in this context, the Davos crowd is meeting and partying, you know, bigger than ever. 1,500 private jets are flying in there. The capitalist gathering where they play and prepare for the next year. And some big capitalists are beginning to raise warnings that, this thing is getting dangerous. We're at a dangerous level here. Ray Dalio, for example, head of the world's biggest hedge fund, Bridgewater Associates, recently on the eve of Davos, was quoted as saying publicly that investors like him had squeezed financial markets all that they could to such levels, quote, where it's difficult to see where you can squeeze further, and that future profits will be low for a very, very long time. This era of free money from the central banks is over, and the global economy is mired in huge amounts of debt. He even compares it to the 1930s, and it won't get over that very soon, and it's very dangerous. Another big capitalist, finance capitalist, Paul Tudor Jones, right, has been warning about the excess cheap credit since 2009 that he said, quote, could be systematically threatening, not just government debt, but corporate debt as well. Corporate bond debt is now $9 trillion. It's more than doubled since 2009, $9 trillion. Most of that is high-risk junk bond debt and just as risky triple B investment grade corporate bond debt. On top of that, you know, you got $1 trillion now leveraged loan market, which is the loan equivalent of junk. Household debt approaching $15 trillion. National government, federal U.S. debt, $21 trillion going to $33 trillion due to the Trump tax cuts, I predict. And that's not counting U.S. state and local government debt. I don't know what that is. That's probably up there, tens of trillions. Or the tens of trillions of dollars in new dollarized debt undertaken by emerging market economies since 2010. Or the $5 trillion in non-performing bank loans out there. And or the private sector debt escalation, corporate and household in China. So we got this massive debt out there, and I've talked about that, you know, listen to my previous shows recently about the relationship between debt and recession. And these guys, Dalio and Tudor Jones, are really warning about this as the global economy slows down. It could be a pending crisis here leading to defaults. And as I said last week, we're already seeing defaults appear. Sears, Penny's is next. General Electric is desperately trying to avoid it, selling off its prime assets, right? We got Deutsche Bank, the Italian banks, a recent report on UBS and Switzerland Bank, Greek banks everywhere, India banks, etc. Troubles everywhere, right? Black swans, as I mentioned, these are coming out of nowhere. You don't know where it's coming and what the effect will be. Can have a real negative overlay effect, you know, like Brexit, Italian government, street protests in France, rightward social political drift, Bolsonaro in Brazil, Macri in Argentina, you know, military invasion of Venezuela, right? Trade war. With China, new Cold War, all of these are new political instabilities that can impact the economy because they work their way through business and consumer confidence and cut consumption and investment already being reduced. I'll finish up with this guy, Seth Klarman, who has the world's biggest fund, the Baupost Group, in his new newsletter, leaked, a private newsletter, leaked by the New York Times, right? Seth Klarman indicated that Trump is quite dangerous to the U.S. economy, and he is leading a retreat from U.S. global leadership, leaving a dangerous vacuum behind. And investors have become too complacent about the global debt and risk levels that now exist. As he said, the U.S. is now at an inflection point. And that, quote, by the time such a crisis hits, it will likely be too late to get our house in order. Well, these statements by these big capitalists, Dalio, Tudor Jones, Klarman, and others, have been echoed, secondarily by central bankers, from Draghi to Janet Yellen and so forth, Bernanke even, and Greenspan says we're already in a recession, you can't get out of it, it's too late, and, the bank research houses here, Nomura and others, are all warning that we're getting close. We're getting close to a global recession and a financial crisis, perhaps. And when you have both occurring, they exacerbate each other. The financial cycles exacerbate the real cycles and vice versa. And that's where you really end up with a big, big problem. That could come 2020, even before that. I predict here. Okay, so that's the Davos crowd are all gathering and partying, on the eve of these warnings coming from the big capitalists themselves, who are more prescient and can see what's happening. And, they're partying on. They've made trillions of dollars, and they expect to make trillions more. And that's the nature of the capitalist instinct here. And they think it's going to be another year, but it could be quite different. And we'll talk about next week again. Tune in, latest in Venezuela and the China-U.S. negotiations.